The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right are Judges Sholin, Bartley, Allen, and Falvey. To my left are Judges Peach, Greenberg, and Toth. We are here today in the matter of Sean Raven against David Shulkin, Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, docket number 16-2057, to consider whether this court's decision in 2001 is still good law. In that decision, Carpenter against Principi, this court held that the fee agreement was unreasonable because it allowed the attorney to collect both an Equal Access to Justice Act fee as well as a contingency fee from his client for work performed under the same claim at the VA. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Please, Court, Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Raven, who is also present, also representing Mr. Raven and his client.
Thank you.
James Drysdale for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. With me is Richard Daly, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you.
I'm Thomas Andrews for the National Organization of Veterans Affairs in this case.
Thank you. Let me just take a moment to thank the amicus for submitting their briefs. And that was the Veterans Justice Group and National Organization of Veterans Advocates. Are parties ready to proceed? Each party will have, the appellants will have 30 minutes, the amicus will have 10 minutes, and the secretary will have 40 minutes. Mr. Carpenter, would you like to reserve any time for about
10 minutes, please, Your Honor.
10 minutes. And, Mr. Carpenter, it's good to see you here. All is well in the world. You may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Sean Raven. As the court noted, the issue in this case is whether or not the decision in Carpenter should be overturned. I believe that the decision in Carpenter should be overturned because the court relied upon a misinterpretation of the FCAA Section 506, specifically a footnote in the amendment to the Aegis statute that allowed fees to be paid under the Equal Access to Justice Act under Title 28 of the United States Code. Section 506 is titled Fee Agreements. The first sentence of 506 provides only that Section 5904D shall not prevent the award of fees or other expenses under the Aegis statute. Thus, the first sentence means only that the existence of a fee agreement under 38 U.S.C. 5904 will not prevent this court from awarding Aegis fees. It means no more than that. It is the second sentence that created the problem that resulted in the decision in Carpenter. In the second sentence, it refers specifically to an award of fees under Section 5904D and specifically mandates that where a claimant's attorney has received fees for the same work under Section 5904 and Section 2412D, that the claimant's attorney shall refund to the claimant the amount of the smaller fee. That sentence pertains only to the same work performed before this court. It does not and cannot be interpreted as applying the same work concept to work before the agency. The decision in Carpenter was wrongly decided because it interpreted that phrase, same work, as used in 506, to be involved with the performance of work before this court as well as work before the agency. At different times on the same claim. Section 506 is a footnote to Title 28. It pertains to how Title 28 is to be applied in relationship to an award of fees under Section 5904.
Mr. Carpenter, let's just assume for a second that I agreed with you that Carpenter was wrongly decided. It's analytically distinct, though, whether the court should overrule it simply because it was wrong at the time. So, and what I mean by that is stare decisis actually has its strongest hold in the context of a statutory claim because a legislative body can change it if the court, quote, got it wrong, as opposed to a constitutional question where if the court speaks, that's the end of the matter. Why should the court overturn Carpenter? Is it just because it was wrong, or is there something else that can inform why we would change course?
Well, in addition to it being wrong on the law, as it was interpreted in that case, its continuing effect is why it needs to be changed. Because the continuing effect of Carpenter is that attorneys are required, as this case demonstrates, to offset fees when the offset of fees is not required for work performed before the agency. There is nothing in the plain language of 506 that requires that. The language of 506 speaks only to an award of fees under 5904D and an award of fees under 2412. The award of fees takes place under 5904 because this court makes a decision that results in an award of benefits. And when this court makes a decision that makes an award of benefits, it implicates the provisions of 5904 and requires, if there is a 5904D fee agreement, that the amount of the fee that results from the award of past due benefits is paid to the appellant and the appellant's attorney, as dictated by the language of 5904D. So the reason that Carpenter needs to be overturned is its continuing effect on the operation of the attorney-client relationship as dictated by 5904D.
If I may.
Yes, sir.
I believe lawyers should be paid for their work, but only once. What effect does your argument have on that concept?
It has no effect because under the interpretation that I am urging for 506, the attorney is only paid once for his or her work performed before this court. And when that work is compensated under the Aegis statute and under 5904, the mandate of 506 is that there shall be an offset. The error in Carpenter is that it extended it beyond the parameters of the same work performed before this court to work performed before the agency. And that is in excess of the statutory requirements of 506.
When would this court ever award 5904 past due benefits?
This court would, under 5904D3, be considered to have awarded fees in a decision in which this court reverses the decision of the board and orders the payment of past due benefits as a result of that reversal. That would take place, for example, Your Honor, when this court is hearing a case for an unlawful reduction. And in an unlawful reduction, the VA has specific procedural protections that they have to follow. This court has consistently held that when those protections are not afforded, a decision to reduce is unlawful ab initio.
So your position is, although we are not the body awarding the fees like we adjudicate in an EJA context, we are still awarding the fees by the reversal of the erroneous board decision?
Yes, because that triggers the operation of 5904D under the language of both 506C and under the language of 5904D3, as that has been interpreted by the agency at 38 CFR 14.636H3.
So in that instance, an attorney would need to offset the EJA.
He would, Your Honor, or she would.
And if it was an instance where the court said you get TDIU or something like that, that's going to result in an award of benefits as opposed to VA having to assign a rating, would that be the same kind of instance?
Yes, Your Honor. The example would be this court's decision in Beatty, in which the court did exactly that, reversed the denial of an extra scheduler total rating and indicated that the award should be made forthwith. That results in an award of past due benefits as contemplated by 5904. And that is the triggering mechanism under 5904 that entitles the veteran, the attorney to receive fees from the veteran's award of past due benefits.
Mr. Carpenter, is there any significance to the amendments to 5904, I believe, in 2006?
I believe there is, Your Honor, as it relates to understanding the analysis that was made in Carpenter. And I think that the analysis made in Carpenter had to do with a misunderstanding because of what the full court at that time perceived to be an ambiguity in the language of 5904 as written. And that the amendment that has taken place in 2006-2007 made clear that the fees that were being paid under 5904 were for services performed before the agency and were not based upon services that were performed before this court.
Does the legislative history support that view?
I have never found any clarity in the legislative history on this issue so that I could say definitively that the legislative history supports one side or the other of the discussion of how Congress intended it, but based upon its plain language in the amended version of 5904, I believe it's in 5904A5, it makes it explicitly clear that the Secretary has been delegated authority to promulgate regulations that deal with the charging of fees for the preparation, presentation, and prosecution of a claim before the Department. Now, what's unusual here, Your Honors, is that Congress created a very unique statutory provision in 5904D. Most statutory provisions give an express authority to the supervising agency or the supervising court to make an award of fees. 5904 does not do that. At 5904C, what Congress did was to describe generally the contractual relationship that was going to be between claimants and their attorneys, and prescribed in C the general relationship with, and gave the time in which the right to charge a fee would start. The right to charge a fee under the original legislation did not start until two things happened: a first final board decision and a contract entered into within 1 year of that decision. The significant change legislatively in the amendment of 5904, when the date or event was moved back to the notice of disagreement, was to remove the time limit. There was no longer a time limit for when an attorney had to be hired, but took it back before the agency so that representation could take place at that point. And in so doing...
Well, wait a minute. Paid representation.
That's paid. That's paid representation.
And your contention is it begins at the notice of disagreement point?
Yes.
When the veteran receives his decision and files a notice of disagreement? That's when the time
starts? The statute actually doesn't talk about receiving a decision as it did in the original version. In the amended version, the existing law presently, which is going to change in February of next year, but the law as it exists today speaks only in terms of the event being after a notice of disagreement in the case. So it doesn't specify it in terms of a temporal time frame as it did in the original version. So it is simply a notice of disagreement, and then after a notice of disagreement has been issued in a case, then at any time thereafter, an attorney is able to be hired and charge a fee. And that's what's unique about 5904C, because it's describing the time at which fees may be charged. Before that date, there is an express prohibition. So before the notice of disagreement, before the board decision under the original version. After that date, fees may be charged. That's all that 5904C says. But 5904D is the really unique statute. 5904D sets out the specific terms and conditions of a fee agreement. And if those terms and conditions are met, then by statute, Congress imposed a burden on the Secretary to withhold the fee up to 20% from the award of past due benefits. There is no award made by the Secretary. The Secretary merely determines whether or not the fee agreement meets the requirements of 5904D, and if so, then the Secretary, as interpreted by this Court in Snyder, is obligated to withhold and pay that fee.
So you're asking us to interpret the statute to, in effect, say this is a self-executing concept.
I believe it is a self-executing.
And the plain meaning of the statute, as you argue, suggests that.
Correct, Your Honor. And it suggests it not only in the way that doesn't affect offset, but it affects it in the way that 506 is written. Because 506 talks about the operation of 5904D. One of the things that they didn't get right in Carpenter was that the fee agreement in Carpenter was a 5904C fee agreement. It was a non-withholding fee agreement. The withholding fee agreement is under 5904D. In 506C, the Congress was only dealing with the circumstances in which there was an award by this Court which would trigger the obligation, the self-executing provisions of 5904, because the claimant is going to get the benefits as a result of that work. And getting the benefits as a result of that work then triggers 5904D for the Secretary to pay, and then that fee must be offset against any fee that was awarded under EJIA.
I understand.
Mr. Carpenter, I mean, I agree with you that the structure here is important between the interplay between 506 and 5904D. And you know, I went through this a million times, right? And 506 is complicated. I mean, syntactically, it's complicated. And to me, I think it ultimately results, and you can read 5904, the interplay, in one of two ways. Either it's it effectively is a price control, a 20% ceiling, right, and that's what Congress effectively intended, or it's essentially a provision against double accounting, against double recovery for the same time.
Well, wait, excuse me, Your Honor, I believe you're confusing 506 with the double dipping provision with 5904D. Well, there's nothing in 5904D that discusses double dipping.
Exactly, but 5904D is a price ceiling. I mean, the relevant part here is it imposes a 20% cap.
It does.
And the question is 506 either allows you out of that cap, right? That's, so it will not apply if the offset for the same work, right? And what I'm really getting at here is somewhat simple, which is the structure of how you would read it ultimately always turns on the definition of the same work, right? I mean,
work is performed.
That's right. It always ends up in the same place, which is what is the definition of same work?
Yes. And it has to be in relationship to what was the event, what caused the 5904D provisions to be activated. And the only event that can trigger that is when this court makes an order reversing the decision and ordering the VA to pay fees. Now, in response to Judge Allen's question earlier about how does that change the operation today, it changes the operation today because this court is going to need, I believe, if you reverse Carpenter, to take a more active role in clarifying in your orders that it is your intention upon reversal that the veteran gets the benefits that he or she was denied as a result of the board decision. Because that is the clear impetus to the action or the self-executing action of 5904D, which cannot be activated otherwise until there is a decision before the agency that there is an entitlement to a fee. What this court does in a remand is not a final disposition of the claim. What this court does in a reversal is, and because it is, 5904D is initiated.
Well, what happens in the remand situation? That's far more typical than reversal.
It is, Your Honor. And what happens is that the right to entitlement continues to be litigated. And until that litigation results in an award, there is no self-executing action of a fee agreement executed under 5904D. And as a result, that can't possibly be the same work as the work performed before this court. As pointed out in one of the amicus briefs, the work that is performed before this court is in the nature of legal briefing. There is an opening brief. There's participation in the conference. There is a response to the government's brief and a reply brief, and if necessary, there's an oral argument. The work performed before the agency on the way up is in the nature of filing a notice of disagreement, evaluating a statement of the case, filing a substantive appeal, filing written argument to the board. Those are fundamentally different work tasks of a lawyer for which he or she is entitled to be compensated for.
But
it is different work.
But Mr. Raven did not represent the veteran on the way up. It was a state veterans group, I believe.
Correct.
And so he did work here.
He did.
And filed for EJA. What did he do whenever the case went down back to the board? Before the board made its decision granting TDIU?
He presented evidence to them based upon a newly revived claim. That claim had presumptively ended when the board made its denial. When this court made its decision to vacate that, the finality of that board decision was undone. So he was back before the agency, as it were, prosecuting that claim.
I understand that, but what exactly did you do? Because in the ROP, it's completely unclear. It looks as though we remanded, and then the board issued a decision granting TDIU.
Okay. I'm sorry, off the top of my head, I don't know. I can consult with my client.
Well, isn't this a matter of an affidavit of services? I mean, isn't this an objective determination? What did he do? When did he do it?
Well, let me simply respond this way, Your Honor. Regardless of what he did or didn't do, the agency made a favorable disposition upon which this court is bound under its own case law that he met the requirements of 5904D to be paid the fee.
Yeah, so, I'm not arguing that. I'm no. just asking.
And I'm sorry, I just don't know. That wasn't one of the things that I...
It wasn't clear from the ROP, because from the ROP...
I can certainly inquire with my client exactly what he did and tell you on
sure.
reply.
Sure, that would be great.
And Mr. Carpenter, I had a follow-up to Judge Barbee's question. Is it your understanding of the board decision in this case that, with respect to the fee issue, that... the board didn't actually even consider the question, which is the same question I had that Judge Bartley had, which is what was done. They simply said, Carpenter says, same work is same claim, this is same claim, full stop. Is that the way you understand the board's decision?
Yes, Your Honor. But one follow-up point to Judge Bartley's question. I think it's important to understand under the interpretation that I believe is the correct interpretation of 506C, in the facts of Mr. Raven's case, Mr. Raven represented Mr. Easterling before this court on a pro bono representation agreement. So he didn't represent him under a 5904D fee agreement. There was no 5904D fee agreement in this case. There was only a pro bono representation, which meant that he would get no fees other than fees that were paid under EJIA. Fees were paid under EJIA because this court made a determination based upon an application that not only did Mr. Easterling prevail, but the government's position in having denied him was not substantially justified. And as a consequence, those EJIA fees were awarded. If my interpretation is correct, then 5904D would not be implicated, self-implicating. And, in fact, the only fee that Mr. Raven would be entitled to, had there been a reversal and an award of benefits, would have been the EJIA fees.
Mr. Carpenter,
yes.
Are you familiar with the Culbertson versus Berryhill case of the Supreme Court?
Yes.
If we assume that the court were to affirm the circuit court and find a cap of 25%, would that have any impact on our decision?
None whatsoever, Your Honor, because the cap is imposed already by Congress under the language of 5904D. If you have a 5904D fee agreement in for representation of a veteran or a claimant, your fee must be capped at 20%.
Wasn't one of the, I think, four different plaintiffs that came together... Wasn't one of their scenarios that they were looking to get an enhanced fee from the court as well, or EJIA or something like that?
I believe
and they
that's
said,
correct.
No, all together, no matter what source, you get 25%.
Yes.
So wouldn't that determination have some relevance to us saying, no matter what the source, you get a 20% from VA?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the mandate of 506 is a simple calculus of the obligation to return to the claimant whichever fee is smaller. So you have the 5904D fee, which is capped, and you have the EJIA fee, which is set by this court. You simply compare those two numbers, and whichever one is smaller is the one that the attorney gets, but only gets when this court has done the same work to generate both of those fees. And that only happens in the circumstance in which this court reverses and orders an award of past due benefits.
Was that the reading of the court before Carpenter? Was that how this court generally interpreted it pre-2001? Which was that it had to be literally an award from us in order for the offset provision to apply.
It's not fully clear. You're asking me to really think back now.
Okay.
I do not believe that is the case. I would refer you or direct your attention to the Fritz case, And the Fritz case was the law, which was partially overruled by Carpenter, as to how they treated the decision about offset. But even in Fritz, they were looking at this by comparing the work done before the agency with the work done before this court, and equated that to being the same work. The same work is only when the same judicial body considers that work, which is why the two Fifth Circuit cases that we rely upon are persuasive. Because under Title 42, Title 42 has a comparable situation in which the court awards fees under both Title 42, under its express statutory authority, and awards fees under the EJA statute.
Well, getting back to that then, in Culbertson, the lower courts relied on or talked about the split in the circuits, and Rice was one of the decisions that they specifically reference as being one of the ones in conflict. So do you still rely on Rice for your persuasive value here at our court, and then say that a reversal of that would have no...
I do, Your Honor, because the problem with the argument that's being made in Culbertson is it goes beyond the plain terms of what in our world is 5904D and EJA. Because 5904D, as I said earlier, has its own self-imposed cap, then that cap cannot be exceeded in order to allow a fee under 5904D, which is all that is covered by 506, not the broader contractual arrangement with 5904C. Okay? But there is no obligation under 506C to offset against any fee that may be paid by the veteran or the claimant to the attorney under a fee agreement under 5904C.
If I may, I have a question about the operation, or I guess technically more the enforcement of the FCAA note to EJA. Let's say that Carpenter is still in operation. VA, which I think they conceded earlier in this case, that the $5,700 should not have been withheld. Let's say it had been given to Mr. Raven along with the rest of the past due benefits. And the note says that the claimant's attorney will refund the claimant the amount of the smaller fee. And because Carpenter, in my imaginary world here, is still operational, well, I guess that's not imaginary because it is still operational. how would that be enforced? What is a veteran do? What if that happened and Mr. Raven did not forward those funds to the veteran? How would that provision be enforced?
The veteran really has two options. The veteran can complain to his state bar, which will obviously affect his ability to continue to practice, or he can complain to the VA General Counsel, and the VA General Counsel has a specific provision that addresses the failure to the overcharging of fees. And if that happens, then that would jeopardize
Could fall under the overcharging of fees?
Certainly. Okay. I have no doubt that the General Counsel would enforce it in precisely that way.
Practically speaking, how would the veteran know about that? He didn't file for EJA, the attorney did. So, I mean, the attorney is the one who knows how much he got or she got from EJA, and then you have a 20% somewhere down the line, and they being the veterans, the VA, the secretary, takes out the EJA fees. Or how is that executed? How does that happen?
Well, I think as Judge Bartley said, the government has already conceded that this should not have happened by withdrawing the fee. It should have been Mr. Raven's responsibility to offset that fee in accordance with Carpenter.
And then how would the claimant know about that? He's just so happy, he or she is just so happy to have won.
Well, I
What do you do as an attorney to your client, say, you about this situation?
You tell them.
I was going to say, my fee agreements, it's all laid out in the fee agreement. And the law is that the EJIA fee is the claimant's fee. It's not the attorney's fee, even though those are the sums that are ultimately paid by the claimant to the veteran.
Well, there's no question the attorney has an obligation to tell the client what happened with regard to this fee award.
That's unquestioned, Your Honor, right. that there is a clear ethical responsibility on the part of the attorney to do that, and that the attorney would do it in such a way as to mislead the veteran or not inform the veteran of that.
That's a discipline issue.
That's a licensure.
That's what I mean.
Issue. Absolutely.
Mr. Carpenter, I'd like to go back to Judge Allen's question about stare decisis.
Mm-hmm.
Assume that the court's prepared to say that Carpenter was wrongly decided and that the 2006 amendments didn't resolve that erroneous decision. Why should the court now, veterans have, and attorneys have set up their contractual relationships under Carpenter? I believe in Carpenter's the law. So they've established those. And Congress in almost 20 years hasn't done anything to resolve Carpenter. Are you asking the court now to overturn Carpenter, and that will have a practical effect of putting less money in veterans' pockets, that we should do that rather than Congress doing that? Because isn't that the practical result?
No, Your Honor, that is not. And any assumption that it puts more money or takes money out of the veteran's pocket is simply incorrect. Under the correct interpretation, the same work, as I said repeatedly, only happens when that work is performed before this court. Now, as Carpenter has been applied, it has been extended to work that is not covered by the 506 offset, which then results in many cases in which veterans lose the opportunity to have attorney representation below because there are less past due benefits at issue than the amount of the EJIA fee. So the attorney walks away saying, economically, I cannot afford to represent you below because I've gotten an EJIA fee that exceeds the total amount of past due benefits that you're going to get, let alone the 20% of that I would receive.
Well, wouldn't in this specific case it result in $5,000 less in the veteran's pocket?
No, Your Honor, because the work performed before this court on behalf of the veteran was compensated for under the Equal Access to Justice Act. All that was received by the veteran from this court was a remand, an entitlement to further adjudication. That entitlement to further adjudication resulted in the award of past due benefits based upon the work of the services provided by Mr. Raven before the agency. And under the plain language of 5904D, he was entitled to the full 20% as the capped contingent fee that he agreed to represent Mr. Easterling for before the agency.
So Mr. Carpenter, I don't think you lose by answering Judge Fawley's question sort of in a common sense way, which is at the end of the day, if the rule as articulated in Carpenter were not applied, then the bank account of Mr. Easterling is simply going to be less than it is if the rule is applied. I mean, that is just a matter of fact.
That is absolutely true, Your Honor.
Okay, and because I think that's what Judge Falvey was asking. But what I want to get back to is, if we look at it that way, that's sort of the way I read the initial Carpenter decision as looking at it, why this would be, using Brown versus Gardner, the way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Just assume that applies to something in one of these statutes. My question is, that will always be the case for each individual veteran. They will always have more money if the Carpenter rule applies than they wouldn't, just as a practical matter.
I'm sorry, which they, Your Honor?
The veteran. it will always be in your response to, in other words, if the attorney has to offset the EJIA fees, any individual veteran in any individual case.
Yes.
But my question is, should we use that metric to do Brown versus Gardner, or should we look at veterans as a group? Which rule is better for veterans as a group? And if we use that, why, in your view, is it a better interpretation for veterans to adopt your interpretation than it would be to use a much more simplistic, which in any individual veteran's case, they would have more money in their pocket if the Carpenter rule stayed in place?
I'm going to attempt to respond to your hypothetical. As you have described it, it seems to me that the reason that that is better for veterans is because veterans get the benefit of the continuity of representation. Carpenter creates an impediment to that continuity that should not exist. It gives lawyers an economic rationalization for not continuing to represent them below, because their EJIA fee will be at jeopardy. For the work that I performed that was documented on my EJIA application that this court found was reasonable, for the work performed from the time that the notice of appeal was filed to the time that the decision was made by this court, that all work is quantified and was considered reasonable, and that's finite. Now that money is now in jeopardy under the rule in Carpenter because it has to be carried forward into the administrative proceeding. And 506 simply does not contemplate that. So to the extent that I was not responding to your question, Judge Falvey, I apologize, but I do think it's important to understand that, yes, money is coming out of the pockets now of attorneys because they're having to offset for different work that was performed. It is money that is coming out of the veteran's pocket because Carpenter was wrongly decided and additional money is put into their pockets that was never contemplated by Congress under 506C.
Thank you.
Now, how would we formulate our holding if we agreed with you without going down a case-by-case, a situation where there's necessarily a case-by-case determination in each? Because you admit that, in answer to Judge Scholin's question earlier, that sometimes the same work, whenever there's a reversal here and a grant of benefits, essentially, the same work is the same work as what happened down below. It's kind of like part and parcel of that. So how would we manage that? How would our holding read to avoid, assuming that there is some kind of priority on not doing a case-by-case determination in each instance?
Well, I don't think a case-by-case basis is required. I think what is required is for this court to interpret 506C to be limited to the same work performed before this court. And when the same work before this court results in the veteran receiving past due benefits from the VA as a result of this court's order of reversal, then offset will be required. And it seems to me to be both a easily articulated rule and an easily enforced rule by this court to put the burden where it was imposed by Congress on the claimant's attorney to return the smaller of those two fees. That if an attorney receives 5904D fees as a result of a reversal by this court and has received EJIA fees, then the smaller of those two fees has to be returned. But that is the limited and only circumstance.
So your argument is that this is the plain meaning of the statute decision for this court, not a balancing of the relative benefits.
No.
Congress intended what it plainly said.
Yes.
And we should
And
apply
it's limited
that.
To what it plainly
right.
said. Unless there's further questions.
Mr. Carpenter, could you consult with your client and have an answer regarding what work was done after the remand from this court?
When I come back? Sure.
When you come back. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Andrews. I'm here on behalf of NOVA, and we thank you for the opportunity to be heard and to brief this issue. Just to start out with just a nuts and bolts answer to a question that Judge Peach asked, whenever I receive an EJIA check, it has both my law firm's name and the client's name on it. So I physically have them come into the office, I give them a copy of it, I have them sign it, and then it gets deposited. So they know that an EJIA fee has been earned and awarded. So that's just, I think that addresses some of the question you had earlier. There are roughly three points I sort of have. One is that 5904, the amendment in 2006, is important. It removes any ambiguity that the court found Carpenter in 2001, and it compels a different result. But I think maybe my value is probably more in talking about the same work, same claim analysis, and why that's practically just not true, and then also the practical impact of Carpenter and how it hasn't necessarily benefited veterans in the way that I think the court in Carpenter thought was going to happen. Again, I'm at the court, so as I'll talk about anything you want. But whenever we talk about same work versus same claim, we know under an EJIA application, we have to give a detailed summary of our time. So we know that's accounted for. But then we also know that whenever I'm working before this court, I'm principally looking through the record, trying to find problems with the board decision. Most of the time, that's going to be a reason and basis error. I'm going to find something that they didn't address or they addressed improperly, and I'm going to use that to try to find a remand. Whenever I get that remand, I then turn to a more constructive argument. That's when I'm going to try to obtain more medical records, oftentimes a medical opinion or a vocational expert, where I might try to develop lay evidence. So I go from poking holes in the board decision to actually constructing an argument. And I think those are two different disciplines or two different aspects or types of work. And I think the court should be aware that most of the time, attorneys aren't just waiting for the VA to perform its duty to assist or to comply with the remand and make a good decision. We are developing the case in terms of facts and arguments and pressing the VA for a proper decision. Also, I think it's important to note that I think, this is in our brief, approximately 25% of court remands result in a direct board grant. So most of the time, 75%, it's going to get sent back down. So we're talking about years more of work. This isn't a quick decision that happens.
Where'd you get that statistic?
That was a statistic. I think it was in a Ridgeway article, and I know it's referenced.
He's right behind you.
if he knows better. I'm sorry, I don't have the citation right in front of me, but I know it's in one of my, I think my supplemental.
You just didn't make it up. But is that statistic consistent with your own experience, broadly speaking?
Let me back up and say, I think that statistic was from 2011. I think that's whenever I read the article, that's when they had that data from. So it's a little old. That is consistent. I usually see the board decision as my best chance to get a good, quick decision by a higher-level person. So whenever I have a remand, coming back to the board, I see that as a really valuable time in the life of my client's case. And I really try my best to develop additional evidence, usually in the form of a vocational expert or a medical expert or lay evidence, to try to win at that point. Because I know if I don't win at that point, I sort of enter the hamster wheel again. And so that, I just want to bring that to the court's attention, that most of the time, we're going to end up in a remand in years more of effort. And that really, we make a numbers argument in our initial brief, and there we try to lay out, we looked at cases from 2016, we look at EJ awards for JMRs and memo decisions and panel decisions, and lay out sort of those numbers and for you. What we're really trying to impress upon you is that oftentimes those EJ fees, if they don't totally outstrip an award, they significantly reduce it. And so I think the result is that the court, after Carpenter, is either trading on the benevolence of attorneys to keep working on a case, to not carve out a limited scope representation where they're just representing the client at the court. You're either trading on our benevolence, or you're incentivizing us to only handle a portion of the case. And I can tell you that is what happens to a high degree. We have attorneys who are using limited scope agreements to just represent before this court. And oftentimes, the veteran might just return back to a VSO who continues to provide them good work or good efforts, or they might be by themselves, or they might go find an attorney. I've taken on cases where I've gone back and looked at it and said, oh, there was a JMR by someone else, and now, 3 years later, I'm handling the case. So we're back on the hamster wheel. So fundamentally, if the court and Carpenter was concerned about who would benefit from that EJA fee, if they were concerned about enhancement of fees, the court should be aware that that isn't necessarily true. Through the use of these limited scope representation agreements, it's not necessarily true that the veteran is going to have an enhanced award.
Is that something that regularly happens, where you'd have to have a sizable EJA, you figure I'm going to work for free, so pass to another attorney? Is that?
Yes, sir.
That's a regular.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's any one of the three things you just mentioned. Well, another attorney, he represents himself, or the VSO?
And what I find difficult about this is, so a JMR, let's say a JMR or a memo decision is obtained by counsel, and suddenly he says, you know, looking at how much you're likely to get, economically, it doesn't make sense to continue this case, and I did just have a representation agreement that talked just about the court. I can't continue to represent you. This is really, I think, a critical time in the life of the case. I think the board decision there is really their best chance at a quick decision by a high-level person.
I know it's your third argument. You're going to kind of get to the equities, and I think you're sort of here now, and I wanted you to sort of speak to what Judge Falvey and Alan were talking about, where it strikes me there's a sort of inverse equities here, where what might be good for an individual veteran is, you know, bad for veterans in the aggregate, vice versa. You know, the system that would allow for more representation would actually take money out of the pocket of an individual veteran. So can you kind of speak to those equities?
Well, I think it's important. I think there's a value that we should have a choice of representation. The VA admits that, and CFR Section 3103E, they say choice of representation is important at every stage of the prosecution of a claim. So that's a value that they, and I think this court should uphold, the opportunity for a veteran to choose who they want to counsel them. But we've incentivized something. The court, through Carpenter, has made that difficult.
So do we, though, does NOVA have a position for purposes of this about the level, to follow up on Judge Toth, the metric we use to employ whatever the interpretive framework of Brown versus Gardner is? In other words, do we look at the individual veteran or do we look at the collective? Because I think in many cases, it won't matter which one you pick. I think Judge Toth is correct. Here it does, actually.
And I think you actually raised this in the initial argument. You asked, is Gardner just a macro or micro thing? Does it just apply to the whole system or just the veteran? When I read Gardner, I don't think it's clear. I don't think there's a limitation on applying it to the whole system as opposed to just a veteran. I don't see that anywhere in the case law. I tried to go back and review Gardner case law to answer this question because I thought it might come. I never found a specific case where they said, this is what's best for all veterans. I think that has to do with sort of the limited view of this court in most cases. I think that's expanding now with potentials of class action. So I think this is going to be something you're going to grapple with on a bigger basis, where Gardner, how it applies to everyone, how it applies to the whole system is important and has value as opposed to just the veteran. I will say I think just applying it in terms of the veteran in this case really just enforces the churn and hamster wheel effect of VA benefits, where you potentially have a attorney at this level but not down below, not necessarily by the veteran's choice. And without that guidance, I think sometimes they can miss opportunities. I can see my time is fast elapsing. We thank you for the time to speak. Anyone has any questions?
Thank you. Mr. Drysdale, Mr. Carpenter received 25 minutes in addition to his allotted time. If you need that, you may have it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the Court? The Secretary is here today as a de facto trustee and advocate for our nation's veterans whose benefits would be reduced if the longstanding Carpenter rule were not maintained. This Court has recognized that protecting the interests of veterans is paramount and has affirmed that the statutory history governing the payment of EJA fees reflects congressional intent to protect the veterans' benefits that they have earned from being diminished. The Secretary seeks to maintain a clear, uniform rule that can be applied simply and consistently across the VA system. The Federal Circuit earlier this year discussed the possibility of satellite litigation in cases, in Bly, discussed this satellite litigation, which adds costs and delays to the system overall without ever reaching the merits of cases. And that concern is also echoed in Chief Judge Kramer's Carpenter dissent, discussing the complexity and of attorney fee issues. The VA fee system was purposely designed to be simple and to function uniformly and clearly.
Well, so wouldn't the, on the uniformity point, wouldn't, if the court adopted, I think Mr. Carpenter was responding to Judge Barkley, simply adopted the rule that said, when this court reverses and orders the award of benefits, then an offset occurs. I mean, that would clear up satellite litigation, effectively just like the Carpenter rule, right?
And I believe that's essentially the rule that the court had in Shaw, which was overruled in Fritz and then Carpenter. And it is a clear rule, but that doesn't encompass all of the different situations that may arise.
Well, why wouldn't it? If the rule were there must be a reversal and an award of benefits, then in any case in which we didn't reverse and award the award of benefits, it would fall on one side of the line and not. I mean, this might not be the right line, but it's just, if we're just worried about line drawing, once we pick a line and draw it, then this argument that there'd be satellite litigation can be off the table. Oh, the satellite litigation argument, it strikes me, is one that's predicated on a case-by-case individual balancing approach. That might lead to satellite litigation. Right?
Exactly, and that is the outcome the Secretary would hope to avoid, to have a clear rule that can be easily applied and not have a case-by-case functional approach that looks at line-by-line items to determine whether a specific task performed before the agency was the same as the specific task performed before the court, because any determination VA makes under that type of approach would then be appealable to the board, and then those cases could be appealed to this court, and that is the litigation and costs that the causes litigation and delay and cost, and really diverts VA's focus and attention from determining the merits of cases. And the whole VA fee system was set up in order to allow the focus to be on deciding merits cases and not do all of this attorney fee litigation. there's a presumption that any fee up to 20% is reasonable. That's purposefully in the statute in order to simplify.
Mr. Drysdale, if I can interject. One area that I have questions about ambiguity in this current system is under the scenario that the appellant and Amiki described, where a attorney number one represents the veteran here at the court, it receives a remand, receives EJA, then cuts the veteran loose, attorney number two picks up the case at the board or below or whatever, and the veteran is ultimately successful. Attorney number two has a fee agreement that calls for past due benefits. Does attorney number two receive the full 20%, or is he required to offset by the EJA that attorney number one received?
I believe that the way it functions is that the full 20% is paid to the attorney who represents subsequently.
Then what's the difference?
Well,
the veteran is still getting less money, right?
Under that situation where they switch attorneys after a remand, then yes, and that is a quirk or a flaw in the way this does work. But that is does not mean that all veterans should be having their fees reduced or the benefits they receive reduced, because it is possible that it can be done in some cases.
So if attorney number one had continued and attorney number two was not involved, attorney number one would have those fees offset?
Yes, Your Honor, under the Carpenter rule, as it functions now.
Yeah, but what about the statute?
Under
the statutory scheme that Mr. Carpenter is arguing, I mean, it doesn't seem logical that if you admit that attorney number one and attorney number two are doing the same work on remand, but there's two different attorneys, attorney number two gets fully paid, but attorney number one doesn't. Isn't that what you're arguing here?
I don't think we're arguing that they're doing the. I don't think I understand your question, Your Honor. If you're asking whether it makes sense that switching representation would allow for two attorneys to receive fees that one attorney could not if they had continued, then I believe that is the way that it works under the current approach.
So that's the way it works, and you think that's the way it ought to work?
Well, I can't.
Apart from what the court has done, we're confronted with this issue now.
Well, the alternative would be that every veteran would have their fees reduced.
Or the alternative is that every attorney would have their fee reduced, irrespective of whether they were the one who did the representation at the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Unless you interpret the note as meaning that is only addressing a single attorney. I mean, that the note really only applied where there was it contemplated that there was a single attorney through the process, I guess.
Right. That is an interpretation a way to interpret it.
So Mr. Drysdale, you know, I sort of spent my legal career, you know, being a law professor before this gig, and, you know, law professors are the pointy-head people. They try to make things complicated. But what about something simple like this? We just all know that in most situations, what is actually done here at the court by a lawyer is not even remotely close to what is done when you get back before the agency. Right? I mean, that's just that is just true. Nobody is going to develop evidence here. Nobody's going to give me a new medical exam or say, hey, you know, I'd like you to hear from a vocational expert, or here's a new statement from my husband or my wife, right? It just, what's wrong with a very common sense approach that to say that the work here is the same as the work at the agency is simply just not true?
Well, it depends on how you interpret same work. And if you mean that to mean same tasks, same specific tasks, then what you say is correct. However, if you view same work more broadly, as the en banc court did in Carpenter, meaning your work is you are working to assist the veteran to receive benefits, then that is the same. It's about how you define that term, and I believe, as Judge Toth pointed out, really any way you read these, it comes back to the interpretation of how you define same work and whether you define that very narrowly and granularly to mean the same tasks that you filed this document or that, or if you read that more broadly to mean you're pursuing benefits on behalf of your client. And that does, and that's a, you know, the en banc court and Carpenter construed it broadly. And Congress has changed the statute, amended it several times in since, has not disturbed that interpretation or sought to change it. And I think that the points made in earlier with regard to stare decisis are important, because Congress has had the opportunity to revisit this, and they've not done that.
Now, what about the impact of the amendments in 2006? It says department. It says nothing about the court.
Well, Your Honor, the amendment also said before the department in the prior version. The language is there. It wasn't an intent to address this specific issue. The amendments were to allow veterans to obtain representation at an earlier stage of proceedings, not to change the interpretation of Carpenter such that more fees are withheld from veterans and paid to attorneys.
But maybe that's a collateral impact of the amendment.
I haven't been able to find anything in the legislative history that would suggest that. And in fact,
or the opposite.
Well, the legislative history really does seem to emphasize that Congress was concerned about creating the perception that an attorney was necessary, or implying that an attorney was necessary for proceedings before the department. It's fundamental that the proceedings there are intended to be non-adversarial and veteran-friendly, and things such as the duty to assist and the duty to notify work to support that. And there's no indication that Congress was very careful. They didn't want to give the perception that you needed an attorney to move through the VA process.
Would you say that it is possible for an attorney to perform the same work before this court and before the board?
Again, it depends on how you define same work. I mean, if you're talking about a task-by-task thing, I mean, reviewing the record, reviewing a board decision or, proceedings below, that could be a same,
task. But the record could be a claims file. The record here is not.
Right, and in a post-remand, if an attorney comes into the court and then represents post-remand, reviewing, the record and those things, it could be, there could be overlap in specific tasks if it's defined that narrowly. But if it's defined more broadly, and as the court did in Carpenter, pursuing the claim, pursuing benefits on behalf of your veteran, then that is the same. You're doing the same thing. You're doing pursuing the same goal, pursuing the same benefit at the end of the day. In the case where I have a final board denial, when that comes to the court, attaining a remand there keeps the claim alive. Without that work, it's over for the veteran. So once it goes back, then you're continuing to pursue that same goal that you pursued at the court, that you pursued before, that you pursue after.
Well, That's a very broad interpretation.
Well, and that's what the court in Carpenter en banc, they held. That's what they held. And it, Congress hasn't changed that, despite having amended 5904 in the interim. And when we talk about, the equities, whether this may affect one veteran versus the veterans population at large, I mean, that's really a policy determination that Congress would be best to make.
And so it's an interesting case, and I mean, your position is that VA really has no dog in this fight other than just having a clear, manageable rule. Is there any other position?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the VA pays the same amount.
Sure.
Under any scenario here. The question is whether the veteran gets to keep more of the benefits which they've been granted, or whether more of that goes to attorneys to help subsidize the bar to provide more representation writ large. And so VA does have an interest in standing with veterans. I mean, as I began, we are here today as a de facto trustee for our nation's veterans. And trustees generally preserve assets. I mean, it's a basic role. So we are here with the veterans standing to ask that they be allowed to retain more of the dollars that Congress intended to for them when these veterans benefits laws were granted. When these laws were written, no one in Congress thought that this should be paid to attorneys. These were written for disabled veterans, their dependents, and those are the intended beneficiaries.
But attorneys weren't really a part of that system when these laws were written, right?
That's true.
And that whole landscape is changing.
But it is, Your Honor. It is.
Mr. Dreiser, you had said something in response to Judge Tolta a minute ago about looking at the system writ large versus individual. And then you said something about it being a question of policy. But that rule from Brown versus Gardner is a direction about how a court interprets a statute, right, fundamentally.
Right.
So what is the what's the Secretary's position about the right lens to use? So when a court employs the Brown versus Gardner presumption, does it look at an individual veteran person before, or do we look at the universe of veterans so that that's the right metric to use?
I don't think the Supreme Court has given any particular guidance about how broadly or narrowly that should be used, and it's the subject of intense academic debate, as you I'm sure know, that the question about that really how you define that scope is really the question. And in this particular case, the intended beneficiaries of veterans' benefits and of EJA are the veterans themselves. So as it's applied in this case, it would make sense to allow veterans to keep the dollars that for the benefits that were intended for them.
So the presumption can't operate differently in different cases, at least in my view. In other words, either it operates because we only look at the individual veteran, or the presumption operates by looking at the group of veterans. And in maybe it's in 95% of the cases, those two things are coextensive. You get the same answer, so it doesn't matter. But if you take an example like might exist here, where for any individual veteran, we know that they will just have more money in their pocket, but just assume with me that veterans writ large have fewer choices of representation, right? So what is the lens that we should use as a court in employing Brown versus Gardner?
Well, I think if pushed to provide an answer, would have to be you look at the individual veterans. And I think there's support from that can be bound in statutes and regulations. 5107, benefit of the doubt, 3.103, 4.7, all of these things apply to individual veterans in their cases.
Well, there isn't. Is there another way to look at this? That the term, you know, whatever benefits the veteran should be the interpretation. I mean, does that mean only a financial benefit, or is there another kind of benefit that is less tangible than financial at issue in some cases? Such as the ability to get uniform representation, you know, at the court and down below before VA.
Well, there are plenty of examples of attorneys who continue to represent veterans after a remand from this court below. And so the fact that some do not isn't necessarily representative that it's impossible to do so, because there are plenty of attorneys who do that. And it's not as if veterans are without assistance or the ability to have legal representation of some sort after a remand from this court, because veterans may choose to work with pro bono organizations or with their veteran service organizations, and they can have the choice to do that. They may want a specialist who works in this court to help them with their remand, and then they can retain the 20% of past due benefits below. The limited scope representation agreements and the choice to be able to do that is something that should be encouraged, because it gives the veterans the most flexibility and choice to decide how to proceed with their claims and whether they believe that retaining that 20% is important to them. Many veterans may want to keep that percentage instead of paying it to a representative.
But wouldn't that same choice be available to a veteran if Carpenter were not the rule? They could hire somebody to represent them here at the court, assuming that's successful. They then fire their attorney or only have a limited engagement to begin with, to only have representation at the court, and then they could return to their VSO or own representation or whatever below. I don't see that the same work limitation or whatever enhances or inhibits that choice.
Well, I don't see, like, the way Carpenter functions now, I don't see how it would really apply in that type of situation if they choose to go without, you know, an attorney during the proceedings post-remand. There would be nothing to offset at that point.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
So maintaining the rule protects the veterans who do choose to do that, and protects them against having fees diminished.
Because they can get a whole other attorney who gets paid 20%.
If the
fee is diminished.
That's part of the calculus and the choice that is made. And I admit that is not a perfect result and should be considered by VA going forward. But as it stands now, I believe that is how it works. Because the VA system functions, the fee payment system functions rather simply and informally. VA pays the entire EJA amount to the attorney. VA pays the entire 20% to the attorney. It's simple on the administrative front on that side, and it's the attorney's ethical obligations and duties to refund back the lesser amount. So, you know, the
except when VA accidentally withholds the amount that they're supposed to pay the attorney.
Right, and again, the Secretary has conceded that in this particular case that should not have been done, and it was, frankly, I think someone on the front line trying to protect the veteran and withhold that for them. But, again, that should have been released, and it is the attorney's obligation to then effectuate the refund.
I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Carpenter about the Culbertson case. if that were decided and the circuit court's opinion were upheld, how do you think that, that creating that uniform rule about the section, the Social Security provisions would apply, yes, would affect this inquiry?
Right. So if the judgment below were affirmed, then that strongly supports VA's position here, because there would be a 25% cap and maximum under 46A, 46B, as offset by EJA. That would be 25% of past due benefits is the maximum. So if the judgment below is reversed, that would be neutral to the VA's argument here, because the VA system is structured differently than the Social Security system. You don't have the equivalent of a 406A and 406B structure in VA law. So it's been the Secretary's position consistently since the outset of this litigation that it would have no effect on the argument because the structure is different.
The structure is different in the circumstance if the case were reversed, but the difference in structure wouldn't be a factor if Culbertson was affirmed.
Right. If the
and why do you think that is? Because of the language in EJA or because of something else?
Because under 406B in the Social Security Act, that must be offset by EJA. And then that amount as offset then combines with work with the agency, and collectively that is subject to a 25% cap.
So it's the EJA component of that, not the 406 component, that you're saying supports your position?
Right. I believe so, because there's a required offset in Social Security, which then combines with the agency fee, work for the agency under 406A, which would then be subject to the strict 25% cap. But it's been VA's consistent position throughout this litigation that the difference in the structure of the Social Security fee scheme and VA fee scheme, the VA cases, Rice, and the cases relied upon by appellant from the outset really are distinguishable and have no application in VA law, because the whole statutory scheme is different, so it can't really be easily
translated.
But to the extent the Supreme Court may hold that regardless of any of those, anything at the court, anything below, subject to a strict 25% cap, then that would be analogous to the situation where EJA fees offset the 20% up to 20% contingency fee below.
So, Mr. Drysdale, is there absolutely no analogy between 5904 and 2412 as compared to 406 A and B in terms of the impact of the offset, the same work?
It doesn't support the weight that appellant places it on it because it is different.
And as to my question, just getting back to it about there being benefits to the veteran other than financial, so you would the Secretary concede under Brown versus Gardner that indeed some that the language that is used to capture the that doctrine that it includes something other than financial, or it may?
The way I understand the holding of Brown v. Gardner is that any statutory, any doubt in statutory interpretation should be resolved in the veteran's favor. So,
And the veteran's favor, what does that mean? I mean, could it include other things other than financial considerations?
Such as health care?
Such as
the benefits that we're talking about here that the appellant is arguing. Intangible things.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we don't... accept your view and keep Carpenter intact, let's say we want to fiddle with it, to the Secretary, which would be preferable, a case-by-case determination as to same work or a more bright-line rule such as appellant's counsel suggested, meaning none of it is the same work unless we reverse?
Well, the Secretary would seek to avoid the type of case-by-case, task-by-task type of analysis, but doesn't necessarily endorse the alternative the appellant is proposing, which you were just asked. Because the situation where there is a reversal by this court and a grant for benefits, or remand with instruction for VA to grant benefits, that is that's an example of the type of situation where you may have, you know, same work. But that's not the only type of situation where there is, where you have differences in same work. It doesn't capture everything.
Right. And so if we did not want to leave Carpenter intact, it sounds like a case-by-case might be preferable to the Secretary?
Your Honor, the Secretary seeks to maintain a clear, uniform rule that can be applied simply and consistently. If we have these decisions about granular tasks in basically every case that's remanded by this court that then results in a grant of benefits below, then you have the possibility for all that satellite litigation that redirects VA's resources and efforts not on the merits of cases but on attorney fee disputes that are go to the board, have costs and delay there, appealed to this court, creating additional delay, and you know, that sort of functional case-by-case approach, the Federal Circuit looked at that in Bly and said, you know, that's not something we want to do in the EJA context. We want to create these clear, bright rules. And Carpenter does that.
So, but for Judge Bartley's question, which is the same one I have, is assume that we are not going to keep the Carpenter rule, okay? And I understand the Secretary's position is the worst case scenario in that example would be, or in that situation, would be a case-by-case approach. Bad. And then you've said the bright-line rule that Mr. Carpenter, who's here, articulated for us is not what the Secretary would do. What then rule would you want us to write down that is a bright-line rule and that isn't the current Carpenter rule?
Well, there are examples where you do not have the same work. A sort of a categorical approach when you have issues of your clear and unmistakable error. If you have a final decision and then, where an attorney is represented and been paid and then subsequently comes in with that type of situation, it involves the same claim, the same benefit, but it is distinct. The same thing with new and material evidence when you have situations like that. It involves the same claim and the same benefit, but you have finality, and then you have the next thing, and you could be paid potentially for both. So some type of categorical approach may be more workable, but, Your Honor, honestly, something that the Secretary advocates for. We want to maintain the type of Carpenter rule that is clear, easy to administer, and inures to the benefit of the veterans involved. The alternative that the alternatives that have been proposed really are unworkable and are not and sort of overbroad, but the the rule that's in place functions well and inures to the benefit of individual veterans, and that they get to keep the dollars from the benefits that that were intended for them, and doing otherwise really takes funds from every veteran to subsidize all veterans, where I think the most direct and most the way to benefit in veterans is to give them the benefits that they've been awarded and not diminish those to subsidize all veterans.
Now, one last question. We're all tired here. The turmoil, extra money, et cetera, that a case-by-case determination would involve, isn't that to a large degree dependent on the secretary and what he chooses to litigate as same work? I mean, let's say he decided to just let the little stuff go. the line-by-line comparison and kind of step back and look at things. Isn't that somewhat within his...
Well, but it's hard to do. That would be hard to do because under contingency fee agreements, I don't believe most attorneys maintain that type of detailed billing statement or record such that even that kind of comparison could really take place. Typically, with the up to 20% being presumed reasonable, if you succeed, you're paid that benefit. So there's not this type of detailed billing record that's submitted to VA that could then be reviewed and compared. And, I mean, maybe that would be...
Well, but you're the one who's raising the specter of a ton of extra litigation over this, but now you're saying it actually couldn't occur because the record keeping is not the kind of record keeping that you would need?
As it stands now, veterans attorneys typically do not maintain, or at least they don't submit, any type of information like that. And if the court were to change the Carpenter rule, require this type of offset, then there is an additional burden on veterans attorneys to then do that and produce it and then have VA compare it. But it's not something they're required to do under any VA regulation. They just simply don't have to do any of that. If the fee landscape shifts by a decision of this court, then that may be a result. It's not that it's impossible, but it's not done now, and it would have to be done for that type of comparison to take place if the rule changed.
Any questions?
So there was a question about what work Mr. Raven did below, and that should be addressed on the rebuttal. But I wanted to point out that information is not necessarily in the record of proceeding, although it is in the record of the agency. It seems that, and I don't want to go too broadly, we can supplement the record of proceeding, but after remand, there were several requests for copies of the claims file, and a couple, a document with a couple, two pages, I believe, of argument that were submitted to the board, and that did then result in the award of fees below, for which appellant's counsel, the 20%, was something like $17,000 for requesting a copy of the claims file after having an RBA from the court and then submitting a two-page argument. So when you look at...
But just to be clear, you agree that the board decision that we're reviewing, it didn't get into any of that because it just said Carpenter says this and this is what's going to happen?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding that. Right.
There have been specific questions about what work was done by appellant's counsel post-remand from this court, and I know the answer to that and wanted to provide it with the caveat that that is not currently in the record of proceeding because at the outset that did not appear to be necessary, but we were happy to supplement the record of proceeding to provide that to the court.
Okay.
There are no further questions. The Secretary asked the court to reject appellant's invitation, to reverse its subtle precedent, and to affirm the board's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Tricazio. And I would ask you to supplement the record with that submission.
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I have the record identification and I would affirm what was said by the government that these are RBA sites. They're not in the ROP because neither side thought that they were particularly pertinent, but I'm happy to have the record expanded. Mr. Raven submitted written argument on September 15th of 2011 following the remand from this court. It's in the record at 233 to 235. That resulted in a board decision on December 5, 2011, which granted TDIU but did not assign an effective date, and that's in the record at 222 to 230. The effective date decision was made implementing the board's rating decision on January 4, 2012, and that's in the record at 199 to 203. Those proceedings, and particularly the work done in the written argument in September 2011, were the basis for the 5904D fee award that is the subject matter of this proceeding. However, the record also contains a notice of disagreement on the effective date assignment. So there was a continuation of representation of Mr. Easterling below, which resulted in the submission of new evidence after the filing of the notice of disagreement, a statement of case, and a VA-9, and that is where that issue is at this point in time. Right.
But the fee that he, the 20%, was based on the effective date awarded in the RO decision that's being challenged.
Correct.
So any additional or any backward effective date assigned
would
potentially result in a subsequent fee.
Yes.
Now, would that subsequent fee be subject to offset?
There is nothing in Carpenter that indicates that. That is one of the continuing problems for representatives to figure out, not only your hypothetical, Your Honor, but the hypothetical of what happens with subsequent work. Do you have to continue to offset? Or if it's the same work, are you only offsetting against the same work up until that particular time? That issue has not been litigated before this court or before the VA, as far as I'm aware. So I don't believe there's any resolution on that.
So the effective date issue, Mr. Carpenter, that you just referred to, was an issue that arose after the remand from the court?
Yes, after the favorable decision by the board and the implementation of the award of TDIU, but the board did not assign an effective date. Because the board didn't assign an effective date, the RO was responsible to assign that effective date, which they did in the decision that is the result of the fee dispute or fee issue in this matter. And then that effective date issue is in appellate status. Any further questions about the record then? Okay. I cannot urge the court in stronger terms not to adopt a case-by-case consideration
because it simply cannot be justified under the plain language of 506C. If it could be, then clearly the court should. There is no basis to go to a case by case because the language of the statute is plain on its face. It compares the fees resulting from an award under 5904D to the fees awarded under EJIA, and the claimant's attorney is responsible to return the smaller of the two. That's
so you think there is an analogy to the Social Security structure to some degree with respect to
well, there most certainly is, Your Honor.
And 406 A and B.
Yes, and that is because at the heart of the Social Security decisions, there is agreement that the fees are awarded by the same district court judge for the same work in the same appeal, and that that is the differential. Now, the Culberson case seeks to ask for greater compensation under EJIA because EJIA allows for special factor consideration. If that is allowed, the question that is presented in Culberson is, how does that affect the offset requirement? And I think that it's critical to understand that even this court in Carpenter relied upon the fact that the language in, I believe it is 206C in the Social Security footnote relative to offset, was relied upon by the court in Carpenter because it was so similar to the language in 506C. And it is that similarity that requires the narrow, limited outcome of same work being interpreted as being the same work that is performed in the services provided by an attorney before this court that results in a 5904D award based upon the terms of the fee agreement because this court reversed and ordered benefits. There are no other circumstances. There is no other case-by-case determination because it is a binary choice.
So in your view, Mr. Carpenter, there's not really ambiguity where interpretive doubt needs to be resolved in the veteran's favor under Brown against Gardner?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And so what is your bright line?
The bright line is the nature of the proceedings before this court that resulted in first the award of EJIA and the self-affecting award of fees under 5904. And the only way that that can happen is if there is an award of past due benefits which results from this court's order. So if this court's order in its decision reverses the board and orders that the VA award fees, that is the only circumstance in which, if there is also an award of EJIA fees, in which the offset takes place.
In a reversal, mostly, not a remand.
Only. It cannot apply in a remand because a remand doesn't award benefits. A remand from this court only entitles continued pursuit for the benefits. 5904D operates for the structure of the fee agreement, but the award of benefits, the contingency, simply has not yet taken place. Frankly, I believe that's all I have to say, which I'm sure will come great.
You can't believe that, Mr. Carpenter.
Maybe at this time.
Thank you. No further questions? Okay. Thank you all, and let me just say that at least for me, I'm very impressed with the advocacy today in this case, on this difficult case, and on this issue by all counsel, Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Andrews, and Mr. Drysdale. As you may know, we are in the process of streaming
getting to be able to live stream our oral arguments. And this would be, I wish we had this one already set up. This would be one that I would suggest that people look to for a best practices scenario. But in any event, the case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.
All right.